Bienvenidos a todos a esta clase de Pecs y Moles. Hablo un poco de español, pero mi español técnico es muy malo.
La clase va a ser en inglés, pero pueden hacer preguntas en español y si usan un lenguaje que se usa en bares, puedo entender.
So maybe who's a developer? Okay, everybody's a developer. Who's a tester? So I know at Microsoft we have a clear separation, but here, okay, we have, who does both? Everybody does both. Okay, good. Who's a PM too, and PR and marketing? Okay.
Okay, so let's see. How's the installation going? Yeah, it takes a while. But we can get started. It will eventually finish, and
we can get started with the first part of the tutorial, which is unit testing.
So, another poll. Who does unit testing? Pruebas unitarias.
Yeah, that's more than half the room. Okay, cool.
So we're going to tease your understanding about it, and for the people who don't do it, we're going to go back to the basics about unit testing. Okay, so let's ask open-ended question. ¿Qué es una prueba unitaria? What is a unit test? Anybody has a clear definition in mind? Who wants to jump in? Who's nodding? Okay.
Una prueba que prueba la mínima unidad de código ejecutable en aislamiento, sin tener en cuenta interacción con otras dependencias.
Okay, so that's pretty good. So I'm going to repeat. It's I need to retranslate. Piece of code that tests a unit of code and does it without any dependencies.
Yeah.
Okay. Anything that was missed in this definition is pretty good.
Anybody wants to add a comment?
It only does one way of doing this code, one thing. Like maybe this code does different things, and a unit test is for testing one way or one path or one route.
The unit test is to test one path through the program. Okay, that's really unit. Okay, so let's see. What is a unit test usually? It's a small program with assertion.
So you're right, it should test a unit of program. The whole question is, what is a unit? And one thing we forgot is it has assertions in it. So it's actually stating correctness. It's stating what the outcome of your program execution should do. It's very important to have assertions.
And usually what people do is a unit test is really just a method that usually sets up some data, which is commonly called a range. I have no clue about the translation in Spanish here. And then you use that data in with the API. So in this case, we're going to add an item to a list. So that's the act phase. And then the third phase is about asserting things. So here we assert that when you add an item to a list, you increment the count. It's pretty basic, and it's a unit test. And you're only testing the count property. But in fact, you're testing also add. Okay. Anybody thrown off by these kind of things? And there's plenty of frameworks to go and automate the execution of that. So that's, in the textbooks, what a unit test is. Okay. So during this whole demo, this whole class, we're going to look at this piece of code. So go ahead, read it, understand it, get it into your head. It's a little parser. It reads this file and then looks for strings like this, and when it finds foo equal, returns C. So run the code in your head. I'll give you a couple minutes to do that. Don't use this code at home. You know, don't type too fast. This is not very good. So we start by reading the lines and we iterate over the lines. We look whether the key is called foo. If it's called foo, we return C. Nothing too shocking? Okay, how many bugs do you see in this?
It will never return the equals C, only the equals C.
Yeah, yeah, it returns C. Right. It extracts the key. Reads the value of food. Okay. Okay, so we're going to work on this piece of code that looks very simple, but actually has a lot of issues when you try to unit test it. So it's simple, it's conceptually simple, but we'll see that actually all the issues can be generalized to what you're facing every day. Okay. Okay, so let's talk about various aspects of unit testing. Who uses code coverage?
Yeah, that's so. Who has never heard about code coverage? Don't be shy. Okay, maybe that's not a good question. So a better question would be, how much code coverage do you require your people in your team to achieve? Do you have like some percentile that your manager said, you know, you need to go and achieve some percent to check in your code? Anybody has that in this team?
I really try to raise 100%.
Wow, okay.
But it's not easy.
It's not easy, yeah. 100%. Anybody goes for 50%? 60. 60? Yeah, 60 is pretty good.
Anybody agrees with number 4?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, so
Definitely going for code coverage is good, but it's definitely not enough. It's just half of the picture. In fact, there's our group has done some studies, so it has gone and mined big source depots in Microsoft, and then they looked at histories of bugs coming back from the field, and then they see no clear correlation between code coverage, so code having high code coverage, and quality. And the researcher had two insights there. First, you might have an extremely high code coverage in code that your customer don't run, and poor coverage in code that your customer actually run. So there's this usage problem. And then the second one was that you need high code coverage in parts of your code that are complicated. So if you test all the easy code in your code base, you have a good code coverage. But if you don't test the tricky, intricate piece of code in your code, you're missing the areas where you have a lot of bugs. Okay, so code coverage is good, but not
entirely enough. So today we're going to talk a lot about white box testing, which is a form of testing where you try to achieve maximum coverage in a systematic way. Who has heard about white box testing?
Okay, so it's something you intuitively do when you're trying to test your code. Basically, let's say we already wrote this first unit test, which, what does it do? It creates a file at myapp.ini, and then creates
a content that has foo equals b. Now the question is, how many more tests do I need to achieve 100% code coverage in my original parsing method? So I'm just going to go back quickly. So you have this method, and you know that you have a test case that already has this foo equals. How many more test cases do you need to actually achieve 100% code coverage?
Cyclomatic complexity, at least.
I want a number. In terms of basic block coverage, right? One. Anybody wants to do more? Testers would be like 1,000. Okay, so one is actually enough. And to show that the first test case went here and exited here. And we just need a test case that goes here. And basically would cover all the paths in the method. There's one path that enters the loop, and there's this one path that just goes around the loop in terms of basic blocks. Okay, so, yeah. one way to go there would be to create an empty file. Okay. So basically, that's white box testing. You have some tests, you run the tests, you collect code coverage, you get the colors in the editor, right? And then you figure out interesting inputs so that your program goes into the uncovered branches. And usually it's called white box compared to black box. Black box, you don't know. You just generate random files and then throw them in your application. Okay, so we briefly talked about assertions. Who writes? Do you write assertions, and why do you write them? Who wants to jump in and say something? Okay, nobody writes assertions. Not too much. Even in your tests? Okay, so let's see. Let's help you. Do you agree with the following points? So, would you can assertion be considered as documentation?
Yeah.
Yes. Okay. Can you use them to see whether your program does the right thing?
Yes.
Okay. So let's see. Interestingly, some groups have requirements on the number of assertions per lines of code. So in that sense, that would be number 3. And I'll show you how you can defeat those metrics and still have buggy code. So assertions are very, very important to state what your program is supposed to do. There are checks in your program that are executed, and when your program is incorrect, it fails. If you don't write assertion, usually the only thing you get from unit tests is crashes. Anybody's totally against assertions here? They're not easy to write. Right? So we emphasize a lot about assertions in this talk because you'll see that a tool like PEX feed on them. They really need assertions to give you good bugs. So it's very important for you to write them. And there's a lot of benefits of actually writing assertions. Okay, so let's do a trivial exercise. We have this unit test, which reads a file which has A equals B in it, and then we get the value out of our parser. So what is a good assertion that I should write here? What should I put here in equals? Value equals small. That's pretty good. Anybody wants to say something else? It's a trivial exercise. It's a morning. So. Okay, let's see. Number 1 doesn't seem quite right. Number 2 is okay. What about number 3? It's still correct. It's less precise. So you cannot always have a perfect assertion. Usually you'll have a partial view of the world. What about number 4? Okay, if your manager wants to have X assert per line of code, this is your way out. You can make it arbitrarily complicated so that it's unprovable that it will ever be true or not. Or no assertions, of course. Okay, so number 2 was the best one, but actually number 3 is not bad. The message is, you need assertions in your unit test, otherwise you're not testing anything. Or assertion in your code base. Either one.
Sometimes you assert that the register was an exception, so you put an expected exception.
It's kind of an assertion too, the expected exception or the throws, but it is an assertion. Right. From a program point of view, it is a branch. You catch and then you check whether you have the right exception. Okay, so we've seen that coverage is not quite enough, and we've seen that assertions are useful. Do you know the relationship between the two? This is a very important point. Okay, let's. So,
let's go for.
Do you think what is the best solution? Okay, it's pretty obvious, but 5 is not a good solution. Okay, number 1, number 2, number 4, not so much. So number 3. Okay, so
high code coverage and many assertions.
And in fact, there was a study also done by the same guy at Microsoft, Nachi Nagapan, who looked at this, and they found that having a lot of assertions actually led to quality, so less bugs in the coming from the field. And they were looking at this, and they found some interesting correlation. For example, that it used to be that experienced developer would write assertions; they would write the invariants about the code that they had in their head. So because they were experienced, it was all write good code. And junior developer usually write debugging assertions. They use assertion to understand program. So they have to fix a bug, and then they'll add assertion to catch the bug earlier and earlier. But the insight here is, if you have a high code coverage, and you have a lot of assertion in your code, you're in a much better place than any of the other numbers out there. Number 5 is, well, you're here because you don't really believe in number 5. Okay, so that's the code, we know it. Let's get into the problematic aspect of this test case. So what are we talked about unit testing without dependencies. So what are the dependencies of this piece of code? When you run this piece of code, what do you need around to make it run? A file. And where would that file be? A drive? Anything else? Can we have memory map files? Network? Right. So, might be a network share. You know, you have a memory map drive. Might be the local disk. Things like that. Now, we all use disks. Disks work great. What is the problem of depending on the local disk when you're doing unit testing?
You write things, you clear them.
So somebody could clear it while you're writing to it. Permissions, yes. Anything else?
Being slow.
Slow is a problem too. Anybody ever had a disk full? Yeah, happens. Especially when you're doing some severe testing. When you're trying to map the drive, the map might exist. So there's all kinds of problems, and they're not easy to get right. I mean, security is not an easy model. What works on your machine now will never work on the lab machine because of some weird security setting. Slow test, you know, concurrent test, and so forth. And this is typical from any isolation problem in your unit testing. If your tests depend on a database or live web services or file system, they will be slow. You will have issues that it works for you, it doesn't work for the other guy, and then the tests are non-deterministic and so forth. But there's just a whole range of problems that happens there. They don't tell you that in the unit testing books, but in reality, it just hits you every time you're trying to test real code. It's the isolation problem. So it's really critical. Okay, so just to make you feel the pain, we're going to go and unit test that piece of code. So just to make sure that everybody understands that writing tests that depend on the file system can be tricky. And just to get started with the exercise. So today what you're going to do is first create a memory, map the T drive to the C foo directory. And then create a class library and then copy the snippet, which I forgot to put on the USB stick, but it's in the slides.
And then create a test project and write a unit test that tests at least one path of the project. And I think it's a great way to get started. You know, we're going to do a lot of coding today. So if you're familiar with Visual Studio Unit Test, let's all use that today. Maybe you're using another test framework. But for the simplicity of the class, let's use that guy. So this is the exercise. Get started. I'll be walking along the aisle and helping you guys if there's an issue.
And I will start doing it myself too.
Like I already gave the class. Yeah, I'm hiding all instructions, but okay, so hopefully this wasn't too boring for you guys. This was just the basics. Basically, what is a unit test? What's a good unit test? This is our definition of a good unit test. There's no official one really out there. It's a program that runs fast. If you need a fast system, usually it will run slower, especially if it's a network. The network might time out, so the test is slow. It doesn't have environment dependencies. That means anybody can take your tests and run them on their own machine. And it has assertions. That means it's actually checking that your program is doing something correct. And then you actually want to achieve, you want a bunch of those unit tests and achieve high code coverage. Preferably in the areas where you know your code is complicated. Like this little parser, right, has branches. And we require more than one unit test to be well tested. Okay, anybody has a comment, something to add about this definition?
Fast. It should be fast, but if you're testing a slow process, you can do anything. And you have to still unit test.
But why is it slow?
A complex problem, exponential growing problem, for example.
If you're shipping exponentially growing problems, your customer have a problem, right?
And there's no linear algorithm?
Yes, of course. That's the extreme case.
but in most cases you can find decent linear algorithm. Or at least you should have some kind of feedback to your user if it's exponentially complex. They'll be sitting in front of their screen waiting for the program to come back. But yes, most of the time, if your unit test is slow, it's because of isolation. You know, the usual suspects are a database, a web service, a network connection, you know, anything that takes forever. And they're really easy to write, but then you pay the price later. Okay, so Cesar said no break, so we're not going to take a break. And then, since we're hot, we're going to talk about moles. So, we know there's a problem with file read all lines. How do we go and fix it? Let's say you have this parser in your code base, you've seen that the unit tests aren't working. How would you go and fix that little program?
An IOC.
Sorry? Invection?
An IOC.
Okay, so using a version of control, that means using an interface where you hide the file system. Mm-hmm. Okay. Anybody objects or wants to do something else? So it's a similar idea. Once you have an interface, you can mock it. Any? So the input, instead of reading the file in the method, then pass in the content to the reader. Okay, that's one way to do it. There's many ways to fix that. Number one is quite interesting. You just snapshot the world and replay it ever. It's called TeamLab. This works. Sometimes it's a good solution. Another one would be refactoring. And there's many refactoring we can do here, you know, using streams, for example, which are natural abstractions over data, using it in a file system, so IOC, inversion of control, dependency injection stuff, passing the lines as a parameter, so this was also suggested. Reality check, refactoring is not always an option. You probably know that more than me. For legacy reasons, legal reasons, fear of changing something that works, you don't really refactor. In fact, we would say the norm is more that you don't refactor than you actually refactor. And that's why you need frameworks like MOLS to deal with legacy code. And of course, the guy who wrote that code is long gone, so you cannot blame anybody anymore. Does that ring a bell with you guys, or is it you can always... You have legacy code, you touch it, or are you like staying away from it? Okay, what about just changing file read all lines? Ever thought about that? Hacking into the framework libraries and rewriting what this method does? Let's drill into that. So how would you go and change file read all lines? Extension method, would that work? Unfortunately, I don't think they work on a type, so that's a static method. That's a good try. We forgot about that possibility. Anybody? The obvious answer would be maybe, what about overloading? Static method, right? The CLR doesn't really allow redefining static method. What about recompiling .NET? You have the sources. Yeah, Roger. Even internally, we don't want to do that. You could rewrite it in a language like JavaScript that allows to redefine methods. And a common solution is to use code instrumentation. So you can use a framework like MOLS to help you deal with such cases. So MOLS is going to use, and I'm going to show what it means by code instrumentation. We're going to use some rewriting at runtime to enable the scenarios where you change the implementation of methods you don't know that you couldn't change otherwise. Like these framework libraries, definitely something you don't own.
Okay, so before we go into models, maybe
I want to answer a question of people who are already using a mock framework. And I'm wondering why do those guys come in with yet another one?
Mock you.
Okay, there's already Mock you, there's Rhino, there's third-party companies like TypeMock that provide other things similar to Isolator and things like that. So why did you come out and roll out our own framework? Historically, reason number one is everybody's facing isolation issues, so you cannot avoid it if you want to do unit testing. We spent 4 years telling people to write, you know, componentized code and da-da-da, then realize it wasn't happening. So we needed something specifically designed to work well with pets, and we'll see why. So we built the ultimate mock framework for all our tool. So it was really meant for a machine and usable by humans as a side effect. But then the second reason were we wanted simple, well-defined semantics. What I mean by that is the whole message of MOLS is it allows you to replace any .NET method with the delegate. That's the whole story right there. You can stamp it in your office. That's all you need to explain to your colleagues, damn line. So with this, you can actually do whatever you want. You can isolate from anything. But the only idea is you replace any method with another delegate. And we don't provide any API. You have to write the rest. And of course, it's type safe, but most frameworks are type safe. So MOLS can deal with static type and sealed types, which traditional framework like Mocky or Rhino or NMock cannot do because they haven't implemented a profiler. Isolator can deal with it. But basically, these are the reason why we build MOLS. Is that answering the questions? They're all great frameworks, right? But we're a bit different. Okay, so MOLS allows you to replace any .NET method with the delegate. So what do I mean by that? So let's take our problematic line here, real lines that returns an array of lines.
If you're not familiar with the var keyword, it's just it's still strongly typed.
It's just a shorthand that they introduced in C# 3.0. So don't be thrown off by that. This is not VB, it's still C#.
Is there something similar in Vim?
There's Vim, no?
Well, the Vim is not right.
Yeah. Well, people can be misled. Okay, so the dream here is I want to replace real line by a delegate that returns an empty string. So this is an anonymous method that takes a string and returns an array that is empty. Now, of course, I cannot do that, but that's the wish. Wishing is good. Sometimes it happens. So I'm just basically saying, okay, assign this delegate to the implementation of read all lines, and then something happens, and then all future calls to read all lines actually end up being executing this delegate. So why is that solving our problems?
Because we're achieving isolation.
Then we are achieving isolation. We don't hit the file system anymore. We return this empty array and go on. Okay, and then that is the way it's going to happen with MOLS. So we've tried to be as close as possible to our wish, and this is basically the syntax you'll see all over the place in MOLS. We're going to generate types, for file we're going to generate a type called mfile, and for that method we're going to generate a property called readAllLineString that takes that signature. And it's very important to see that the signatures match. Okay, but the goal was, let's be as close as possible to our wish, which is replacing methods with delegates in an intuitive way. Okay, and these are naming conventions. N, string, this is all naming conventions. And we'll see the details there. So
the first thing you do when you do moles is you generate those M files, M types. So given the file type in system.io, which has this read all lines that returns a string array, the first thing we're going to do is generate an M file, which lives in a subnamespace called system.io.moles. We're going to generate a lot of types, that's for sure. And the second thing we're going to generate is a property who has a setter, and the type of this property is a delegate. Okay, this is where it's supposed to click. So, if you're not familiar with func, funcs are delegates that take a T, which is the argument, and return R. That's why they're written this way, because there's an arrow. T to R, it's a transformation function. So here we have T as a string. That means this is the argument and returns a string array, so that's the return type. So what does it mean here? It means the signature of this method matches precisely the type of this delegate. It means that this means that it's type safe. C# will ensure that you replace one method with another method that is exactly the same in terms of signatures. That's where you get type safety. And you get it for free by C#. Okay, everybody must be like, if you're thrown off, don't worry, we're going to give a demo and then things should be clear. But basically the message is, you shouldn't care really about anything. C# will take care of making sure how you use moles is correct and type safe. And in fact, you'll never see those. These are kind of hidden from you. And I'm just giving you the insider details. So that's how you set up redirection. Now, how do we actually achieve the trick? We use what's commonly called detours. Detour exists in all frameworks. Probably in all runtime, you have a concept of detours. And basically, the thing that happens is, when you look at the original read-all-lines method, right, you have the static method, you have all kind of code here that goes into Win32. This is the thing you want to isolate from. And then we have a component that rewrites this method at runtime. So we don't rewrite on disk, we write just before this method is compiled by the CLR. And what we do is something a bit more complicated, but basically we add a check that checks, hey, is there a delegate? Remember that delegate we set? Is there a delegate that the user set? And if that delegate is set, just call it and return. So it's called a detour or a shortcut. If you set the delegate, we run your delegate and we skip the rest. That's the mental model. That's how you replace method with others. You inject a little shortcut in it. That's how you can understand how moles work. And we'll see in the debugger that you can actually visually see that in the stack trace. You'll see that we'll actually enter real lines and then shortcut out. Right. In reality, the code gen is a bit more complicated. Anybody has questions about this?
Security
implications.
Yeah, in running this kind of code. Because if you're able to emit this kind of code dynamically, then you must be in full
test. Excellent question. Don't do it in production. Okay, the message is clear. Don't do it in production. This is a test tool. Imagine the method called isUserAuthenticated, and then you're replaced by something that returns true always. Okay, you know, security doesn't work anymore. In general, PECs tools that rewrite code are not meant for production. Definitely this one, code coverage is different, but tools like moles, don't use it in production. Not only makes your program slower, but totally unsafe. Hopefully this sticks in your head.
Where does it come, maybe you will explain it later, where does it come the syntaxes or the way, like, why we can use the same name of the method we are writing?
Yeah, so those guys come by the fact that we're going to compile type. We're going to actually generate a bunch of types for you.
and the names are our naming conventions. So,
I forgot to say that in the previous slide.
The naming convention is M plus the type, and then here it's method name plus argument types. So in this case, string. And we do that to find the overloads in the IntelliSense. You see that. But it's basically only naming conventions all over the place.
Okay. And they are documented. Okay. Okay, so we've seen that. Now that I've talked so much, I'm going to give a demo. So stick with me. Don't touch your keyboard. I'll give the demo. And then you'll do the same demo yourself afterwards. Okay? All right. So we are... Let's see. We are in Visual Studio. And then what we're going to do is... two steps. First, we're going to tell the framework, the MOLS framework that we need to isolate from MS Core Lib, which is the assembly that holds the file type. And second, we're going to edit our test case so that it actually runs isolated. Okay. So the experience you're going to see here will probably evolve in future versions. We'll make it more friendly, but this is what it is as it's currently shipped. So you go to your project and you do add new item. And now there is this item added here, moles and stuff for testing. So select that guy and call this MS Core Lib. It's type sensitive, so MS Core Lib moles. My machine is hot, that's not good. The recording. Just gonna make sure it doesn't fry. Okay, press enter. And now you can see that it is actually crunching and generating stuff. So we're basically going and generating one M type for every type in MS Core Lib. There's probably 600 public types that we're going to go through, plus interfaces. So the first time you do that, it takes a while. But everything's cached. So this is inherent to our approach. We pre-generate stuff. We pre-compile it. And then once it's compiled, you know, MS Core Lib never changes on your machine, so you should never have to regenerate that again. In the future, we'll also pre-cache those, but that's the way it is.
If something changes, maybe, I mean, if you are using MOLS to encapsulate something you have done,
yes.
Then every time you need to do something like this, you go to your site, some of your code.
Every time you change the public signature of your any type in your assembly, it will regenerate.
Yes. And it knows when public type changes, or it does it automatically?
It knows. It does it automatically.
Okay. Okay, so what we have now is this file I've added, which has a bunch of files under it, and also this mscorelib.moles.dll. So we've generated the types and added them to the reference in the test project. That means everything is available in the IntelliSense. So you shouldn't worry about anything. Now it's just good old C# experience. So I'm going to do mfile. And you can see there's the little blue guy here. If I hover over this, it tells me that I can add a namespace. You can also access this with control dot. And now I can do read, let's see, all lines. And then this is where we see the naming convention kicking in. So you're looking for the overload that takes a string. There's another overload that takes a string encode and an encoding. I'm going to take the first one. And what do we do? Delegates. Okay. And if you see, there's no more squigglies.
in fact, I can build, and everything, you know, everything is happy. Build succeeded. Yoo-hoo. Okay, so it built, and that means now we can try to run this guy. Okay, so as usual, you can right-click here and run test. Keep this open. Don't need this. Okay, it failed. Let's take a look at the failure. All right, so the failure is related to code instrumentation. The framework is telling you you need to run moles in an instrumented process. So that, what does it mean? You need to run this mode where we actually rewrite methods. And this doesn't happen by chance, by magic. You basically have to run in a special environment. So we try to make it friendly, and there is actually a help here in the text, in the exception, that tells you what to do. So you need to add this attribute to your test case. So I'm going to go and copy that to my test case and run again. If you've done ASP.NET testing, you are familiar with the host type attribute. So now the result is the test is going to run in a process where we rewrite methods. Then the next problem is going to be okay, the next problem is related to trying to replace things in MS Core Lib. Because they are so critical, everybody's using file. We don't actually inject delegates by default, because it would be very detrimental to the performance of the whole application that we instrument the entire base class libraries. So in those cases, you actually need to tell us, look, go and instrument the file type. So that's what this exception is telling us. So again, I used a little hint here, and I go here and add that. If you're not familiar with assembly level attribute, you can define attributes at the assembly level. They have to be on top of the file. This is just a cut and paste of the exception message. So now what should happen is we've actually rewritten file, and the test case should pass. And then just for the sake of it, should be able to I'm not sure how I delete my mapping. Okay, so no more tree drive. So my test case should definitely fail if it's trying to read from that tree drive, and I can run again. I was thinking of having a slide with this, soccer team, vamos! But anyway, so you basically run code that relied on the file system, and you didn't need a file system around. Right? That means this will run on everybody's machine in your team, will run fast. That's what you get with isolation. People will actually want to run your test with respect to try to not run. Okay, so I talked about the debugger, and let's take a look at how this works on our debugger. One of the benefits of using delegates, and in a sense language features, is that you get all the language services, including code coverage and debugging, because C# creates a fully debuggable delegate. That means you can actually step into your mock code and understand what it's doing. So I'm going to go into my reader. So I'm going to press F11. And then here I am. I'm about to read the file. So I'm going to press F11 again. And now I'm in the delegate. Hold on. What happened here? Okay, here's a stack trace. Unit test.
get into the product, enter dangerous area, misquartive, and zoop, shortcut. Here's our little short. Here's the little anonymous method that C sharp generated. Okay, so remember that detour idea where you have this shortcut? This is how you see it. We enter read-only land and we shortcut into our implementation. And we never hit the file system. This is all you need to understand about detours. It's a shortcut.
Can we actually use Reflect to see this code?
So the question is, can you use Reflector to see the instrumented code? So the code that we instrumented only lives in memory. To see the code, you would actually have to spin up load SOS and dub the method body when you break into. Maybe we can do it. Although
later, maybe.
Later, maybe. Yeah, so the problem is you need to go and read the metadata that lives in the process. So no, it's not that easy. Okay, so I can debug these things. This is typical debugging experience, right? So you can do all the thing you do as usual, putting breakpoints and stuff like that. And then return lines is empty array, right? And we continue. And then the rest is trivial. Okay, so that concludes the demo. Now it's gonna be your turn. Where is my slide deck? What time is it? Okay. So let's see. I think I had more slides before actually going to the exercise. So this is just a little exercise to make sure everybody's familiar with delegates. You shouldn't need it when you're using moles, but it's still good to understand the basics. So delegate is a signature of a function. And there's two big families of delegates in .NET. There's func and there is action. Actions are methods that return void, and func return a return type. And the return type is always the last generic argument. So for example, func of string would be the getter of string empty. It's a method that returns a string. It takes no argument. What about number two?
C
plus, yep. Number three? B, yep, B looks good. Number four? I guess number four or number five, which one would you pick? So look at it as a transformation from a string to a bool. Reverse here, string to a bool. Mm-hmm. So number four doesn't exist. Trick. Number six, action event. Capacity, maybe. Setter. Setter hides an argument, right? Number seven. Okay, what is an instance method, anyway? You've done C. So, when you look at this method, you can also view it as a static method that takes a list of t as the first argument, because it's an instance method. It's nicely hidden from you, but it's still there. So this signature actually matches kind of the bare-bone implementation capacity. And then this is string to string array. So this is our guy. Okay. Solution, obvious. Okay, and then the next thing we want to do is a quick intro into lambdas. So what you've seen here is 2.0 syntax for delegates. It's called anonymous method, but there's a new way to do that called pretty delegates, also known as lambdas. You take the name you, which cares you the least. So if we start with this delegate, what we can do with the new notation is get rid of delegates, get rid of the type, and put the equals greater, which is an arrow, right? Who has never seen that? It can definitely throw you off, so that's fine. We're going to use lambdas all over the place. They don't exist. I think they exist in VB, I'm not sure. Maybe in the latest version of VB. Okay, so that's the change. Already less text to write. And then when you only want one expression, you don't need the curly brace. And when you only have one argument, you don't even need the parentheses. So don't be thrown off. This is what you're going to see a lot today. Yeah. Okay. And then we can do the same exercise again. So what would number one match to? No arguments, and obviously returns a string. D. Number two, no arguments, and that means it's a statement, means there's it's a void. That would be C. Number three, takes some argument, and doesn't return anything. B. Number four takes an argument, returns a string. That could be this one. If you consider the static version of it. And then this guy could be exists. Okay, so yeah, lambda become quite intuitive. It's just a matter of practice, but yeah, it takes a while to get used to it. So now we have one more. We have half an hour to do the exercise. I think that's a good timing. Let's do it. So you've seen me in Visual Studio do all the steps of the exercise, and these are summarized here. So what you're going to do is add moles for MS Core Lib in the test project. So go to add new item, moles and stuff for testing, MS Core Lib moles, gonna compile away, and then write the test using moles. So write this m file dot blah blah blah.